Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Sublimely Gothic, the podcast devoted only to the most sordid and macabre tales ever penned to paper. Here you shall explore the darkest jewels of literature with gothic enthusiasts Amy and Jess. Enter this realm at your own risk, for the night is dark and full of terrors. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we are going to talk about The Woman in Black by Susan Hill. Written in 1983, it is the quintessential ghost story set in the English countryside. It has spawned two film adaptations, one in 1989 and one in 2012, where our valiant Arthur Kipps is played by none other than Daniel Radcliffe, aka the boy who lived Harry Potter.
I know you're a Harry Potter fan. I kind of, I'll be honest, forgot that he was in a movie adaptation of this. And when we were looking for gothic books, this was just one on a list. And I thought, oh yeah, The Woman in Black. I'll be honest, I thought this was a lot older than it is.
It's pretty modern. And it's kind of surprising how it's so like recent, because like I was partially listening to the audiobook. I found a free audiobook on YouTube. And a lot of, like, people was like, oh, I need this for my class or for my class. So, like, I feel like in the UK, they do read it a lot in school.
Really? That's really interesting.
So it's a staple for an English class, despite how modern it is. And again, especially for, you know, because it's basically a modern Wuthering Heights, or it's a modern take on a very old storyline.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, it hit all the, like, I mean, of course, we're going to discuss it a little more in detail, but I was really surprised, even though I'd seen the movie, but it had been probably, you know what, I watched the movie when I was like running on a treadmill, and I remember there's a jump scare in it, and I like...
There are many jump scares.
I had a moment, like I'm running on the treadmill, and I was like, oh God. So I'm sure that was awkward to see, but that was kind of all I remembered about it. And then the ending of this book was like, I forgot. It is not uplifting at all. So anyway.
Yes. So I think one thing before we get into our summaries is this story came to mind because, again, I hadn't read the book before, but I had watched the 2012 adaptation and I really liked it. And this was before I read a whole bunch of gothic literature like I do now. But when I watched that movie, again, it was so like scary and... not necessarily scary, but again, suspenseful, I guess is the word. It was so, again, scary, but I liked it so much. And it was that movie and that story that made me realize, okay, I like gothic, I don't like horror.
That, I feel like I've had that realization when we read Edgar Allan Poe. Like there's a, like Poe's horror is too much for me. And that is pretty like, he's, a lot of people read Edgar Allan Poe. So, I mean, I'm in agreement with you. This just hit all the right notes for me as far as gothic literature goes. So, I mean, I was pleased with it. So,
yeah. So, yeah, I just remember, you know, watching the movie and then coming away with that impression that I'm like, okay, like I now understand what I like. I don't like useless gore. I'm not into like Chainsaw Massacre or whatever that crap is. Like, I like the quintessential classic ghost story. And it's even okay if it gets really, really scary as long as it's not super gory.
Yeah, I think that's good. I'm glad we read this then.
Yeah, no, and it was just funny because also just having that realization, it also made me think about, again, what truly scares us. Because there were some people, like, on clips of Woman in Black or comments on the audiobook on YouTube were saying like, oh my God, this scared the crap out of me. And I'm thinking like, yeah, there's a few, but not too much. So I think it just kind of shows like what truly scares us, because I remember an incident when I was younger, my friends and I, like in like middle school, like we were at a sleepover and we were watching this one movie, and it was a movie that I really liked and I was really getting into it, but everyone was terrified. And these are the type of people who would watch gore, and I would hate to watch the gore. So in some ways, people who like the gore, you know, like it all out in front of you. But if you dare to like take it away and like leave it suspenseful to them, that's more terrifying.
That is interesting to like, now I'm curious what the movie was, but I, because there's, you know, I'm trying to think what movie scared me or what, I guess what scares me. Cause I think that's something I realized too, when I was reading this book, like I never felt scared, and gore doesn't scare me so much as it just disturbs me, and how different all of those things are. It's an interesting thing to think about. And now I'm going to be thinking about like what scares me. And this is the silliest thing, because going back and watching this movie, it seems pretty ridiculous, especially now. But the Blair Witch Project scared the hell out of me. I would go to bed and I would look in all four corners of my room before I fell asleep. And I was in high school when this movie came out, but I don't know what. I think the kind of unknown, you know, thing not being resolved, which was scary to me. And that has always been a more effective horror device for me, is letting your mind fill in the gaps a little bit.
Yeah, I think the scariest thing I watched in high school as a kid was The Ring.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, ooh. Just the creepy girl coming out of the TV. And then there was another one. Oh, there was a movie. I think it was called They.
Okay.
And it's basically about like monsters under the bed are real.
That does sound scary.
And they were like disgusting like hybrids of like scorpion / praying mantis, whatever, and they could only come out in the dark, and yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't think I'll.
Again, that scared the crap out of me, and that's what I don't like. But it's like Woman in Black, and it's like, oh, like classic haunted house, yay.
Yeah. This felt like a very condensed version of some of the other books that we've
read. Indeed. So let's hope that, because it was, at least on my Kindle, it was only 165 pages. So let's see if we can do a decent 60-second summary, shall we?
Okay. Okay.
Here, let me time myself in. Okay. 3, 2, 1, go. So we got this solicitor named Arthur Kipps. He goes to settle the affairs of one of his clients, Mrs. Drablow, where she lived in Eelmarsh House. And Eelmarsh House does not have the best reputation in the town. And he goes to her funeral, and he sees this woman in black. And at first she thinks she's real, but then it turns out she's not so real. And all the villagers are terrified of this woman. And no one will help him in terms of, you know, his business at Eelmarsh House, except Kenwick, who's the only one who's brave enough to drive him over there. Then crazy apparitions happen. We see the woman in black. Here's the ghost of the carriage killing the child. And then he finally leaves. Stella's fiance comes home, but Sam's like, if you see the woman in black, a child dies. And then several years later happened, like his own child dies, and then his wife dies. And yeah, that's the end. The woman in black gets her revenge.
Perfect.
Yeah, with 4 seconds to spare.
Okay. Okay. Awesome. Okay. Well, I guess I will go in 3, 2, 1. So the book starts out with Arthur Kipps at a Christmas Eve celebration, and everybody's laughing and saying, oh, it's real fun to tell a ghost story. But Arthur is like, this one is not fun. This is devastating. So then he's reflecting back on his time when he went to a funeral and then went to settle this woman's estate. He has to leave his fiance at home, and he's encounters the woman in black at the funeral, and he's kind of like, is this lady here? You know, she looks pretty sad. So then he hears these horrible noises in the, I think, marsh, but I don't think that's right. Turns out it wasn't just in his head. Things were real. The woman in black comes back to take her revenge, and there is a very tragic ending. I had 1 second left, but I was trying to beat my clock, so I kind of rushed at the end.
Okay. Marsh is the correct word, because the actual house is called Eelmarsh House.
Okay. I almost called it a bog.
No. I think moor would also have been appropriate, but marsh is the one they like to use.
Okay, perfect. Then, good. I'm glad I...
So yeah, to me, it kind of, again, I haven't seen the 1989 adaptation, which shocked me the most to how much the plot deviates from the original story to the Harry Potter actor adaptation that I saw. Like, they changed a lot.
Well, that makes me feel a lot better, because sometimes I think my memory is just going, and you know, I'm like, I am not that old. I shouldn't be going yet. But when I was listening to this book, reading this book, I kept thinking like, I don't remember that, or I don't remember like it being so played up. For some reason, I felt like he was in the movie adaptation. He was in the house more often than he was in this, in the actual story, in the actual book. But I think
that's a fair assessment, which kind of makes sense as a creative decision just for the visuality of film.
Right. Yeah, very true. Very true.
But I think the first thing right out from the gate is, you know, this is told in flashback where he's at a Christmas Eve party with his new wife. And I realized, I'm like, what, you know, for as morbid as the ending is, this is a much, Arthur is able to move on with his life in a way that he didn't in the film.
That is, yeah, that is true. And I totally missed that his new wife, Esme, which I think Stephanie Myers, you know me, my love of Twilight, must have, mm-hmm. I feel like this might have been a little bit of a reference there.
That is certainly as possible.
I like to think that sometimes when I encounter some of these, but Esme's a cool name anyway. But
yeah, but it's telling that even though he has a happy life, all of Esme's children are his stepchildren, so he has no children with Esme.
Okay, yeah, they're all his stepchildren. So she this is not her. Interesting. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So at first I'm like, oh, so this is told wholly in flashback, and he actually did have a life afterwards, which was not how the movie goes, as I remember. But yeah, so that was just glaring difference number one, because, you know, the way the movie ends is he runs to save his child from the train, and they both get hit and smashed, and then he goes up into the afterlife with his wife.
First of all, that is a much, even though tragic, nicer ending than this book. It's like, I think the last line, it says, I'm just looking at something, it says, they have asked for my story, I have told it, enough.
Yeah, and the way they did it in the film, like you see the ghost or the like angel of, you know, his wife, and he walks away with her, so it's like kind of happy, even though it's morbid. And it's, and of course, the endless comments, like in his death scene with the train, it's like, the Hogwarts Express hit Harry.
Oh my God. Yeah, you know what, that's what I love about like fandoms, when like actors appear in something else, there's always like a little bit of integration with those things, like references.
Yeah, and like, don't you know, Harry, the Hogwarts Express waits for no one. Okay, but
I thought it was interesting, yeah, that we read, you know, we read a Christmas Carol, and then we're like, this book starts on Christmas Eve, so I was like, oh, it's like we're, I don't know, it was kind of an unintentional.
Yeah, it was interesting. And I was curious by, oh, it's great to tell ghost stories like on Christmas Eve. And I'm like, that's a Halloween thing. Like, is this an English, like British thing that they would do? Because I never did ghost stories on Christmas.
I didn't either. But I feel like I have heard that that is something that is British. And it might, again, I've referenced it, like Doctor Who. I feel like that is something that they did on Doctor Who, or mentioned on Doctor Who. I don't know. They always have a big Christmas special.
Yeah.
But and I if we could really think it's good to, I think this would be a good tradition to like launch personally.
Yeah, no, I think maybe if you go in the like deep anthropological roots of it, because in the old pagan calendar, Samhain, Halloween was the beginning of the year. And, you know, with winter solstice being the longest night, it would kind of make sense that the darkness of the evening would inspire maybe, you know, those sort of darker stories, because just the level of darkness and night in the longest night of the year.
I think that's a pretty cool thing to do.
Yeah. So we get past so basically the whole story is told in flashback. And so, yeah, so Arthur, as we said in the summary, goes to, what's the name of the little town?
Nine Lives Causeway, but I'm just looking here.
Yeah, I just remember the name of the house, Eelmarsh House.
I don't remember the town, but I do remember him going to the town. Most of the people in Crynith Gifford? Crynith and Gifford?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so again, he is just going there. He doesn't know anyone. He meets Samuel Daly on the train, who's like this really beefy sort of guy and pretty wealthy, prominent member of the town. And so basically, you know, people at first are really like nice to him. And then I think it was very telling that Arthur is like just talking to his the innkeeper, and he's like, oh yeah, I'm gonna go out to like Eomar's house and have to do, you know, blah blah blah. And then like the innkeeper just turns his head and is just like totally like ignoring him, and Arthur is like, what the hell?
Yeah, the place definitely has a reputation that the town kind of reacts to, and it's kind of unfortunate because Arthur kind of seems to like, he very much, I thought was interesting in this, is very much just trying to do his frickin' job. Like, yeah. That is what he's trying to do.
That's all he wants to do. And then, yeah, and then it's going to take, and yeah, just being really frustrated with, because I don't know if he may also be a solicitor. The guy in town, the other lawyer, who's just like completely terrifying. He's like, no one will help you go to Eomar's help and sort out through his things. I mean, no one will help you.
Yeah, he's at this, right. It's like the, oh gosh, I'm thinking of, and now I'm confusing all my books, but I'm pretty sure it's Dracula when, you know, the townspeople are like, don't go to that place. That place is crazy, you know, to Dracula's.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. The Transylvania. Yeah. That's definitely Dracula.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah,
they're telling Harker like, don't go.
Right. Right. And he's like, I mean, whatever. A lot of this aspect of the story reminded me of Jonathan Harker going to Dracula's castle. I know it wasn't a castle, but, you know, it had the same.
Again, the poor solicitor just trying to do his job.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. A running theme in Gothic literature, very rarely talked about.
It's kind of interesting, again, just total side note, the way, you know, we just call them lawyers in the US, but in the UK, that, you know, they separate lawyer in between. You can either be a solicitor or you can be a barrister.
And what is the difference between the two? I don't know.
So the barrister is basically the one that kind of we associate as the lawyer, like who is in court, like defending someone, like the performance theatrical side of it. Mm. Whereas a solicitor is much more the administrative, like stuff behind the scenes. Like a solicitor would not get up in front of a judge and make a defense for someone.
Okay. Okay. That's
they kind of divide the two, and I don't know about the technicalities of requirements, but honestly, if I wanted to go into law, I would prefer to be a solicitor more so than a barrister.
Was just about to say the same thing. I don't need to do a performance. I am more than happy to I don't know if I would take Arthur's job in this situation and sort through all these documents, but yeah, in the scheme of things, that would be my preference as well.
So yeah, so he goes to the funeral of the late deceased Mrs. Dradlow, and he sees the woman in black. And at first he thinks she's just a normal person, like she doesn't look like a ghost, she just looks like a person. And then he tells, like, oh, who was that woman, like, paying her respects or whatever, and then the other solicitor guy is, like, about to, like, shit his pants.
Yes, exactly. That is the best way to describe that reaction, because the, you know, Arthur's like, oh man, I feel so bad for this lady, she looks terrible. And yeah, the reaction is like, oh my god, what?
And it's not even just the woman in black he also sees all the children, and he doesn't know those are all the ghosts of the children that she's killed.
Again, pretty dark. Yeah, but I remember.
Again, it's, you know what's interesting to me about the difference between the book and the movie is, if anything, the book is significantly, to me in any way, less dramatic than the movie adaptation was.
Again, from what I remember of the movie, and it's been a little while, I feel like I agree with that completely. There's more subtlety in the book, but the movie seemed to kind of like really want that jump scare, you know, for.
Yeah, it was really the movie. Again, when we get to the conclusion of the story, that Sam is explaining, like, the reason everyone's so scared is when anytime someone has seen the woman in black, a child will die. And so that's told at the very, very end. And then we finally get the payoff when years later, when Arthur has a child, the woman in black gets revenge on him and kills his child. But in the movie, it's shown that's literally just the rising action of the movie plot. Because it gets to a point, it's not just like Arthur, because Arthur has seen the woman in black multiple times in the book, and like the only child that gets killed is his own later on. But in the movie, it's like every time the woman in black is sighted, a different child in the village is killed.
Well, and that's, and I felt like in the story, that's what they mentioned that. Like, and I'm forgetting the name. When Arthur's talking to Sam, he's like, he kind of keeps checking. He's like, so no kids have died yet, right? And he's like, yeah. And he's like, oh, maybe I beat the curse. And then, you know, the tragedy strikes years later. But the only thing that I couldn't figure out is like, why, what did he think he did to beat, quote unquote, beat the curse? Because I just was like, did I forget something? And maybe I did, but maybe like, I don't know.
It's not that he thought he beat the curse. That is the movie plot, and I'll explain the difference. Like in the book, it's very much, he thinks that because Mrs. Drablow, who ends up being the woman in black's sister, because she has died and she is the last person that like was involved in like taking the woman in black's child away from her. Like he thinks like with her dying, you know, she'll be at rest and won't want to like terrorize everyone, right?
Right, right.
And then the movie, it's much more, he goes way above and beyond where he attempts to, he goes into the marsh to get the child's body and place it in the grave with her. Like that's the movie. And so he tries really hard to like unite them and break the curse. But in the book, it's not about breaking the curse. It's like, well, Mrs. Drablow's dead. All those people are dead now. There's no reason for her to do it, right?
Okay. I'm having like flashbacks of him like wading through all this like foggy marsh to unearth like a body, which is, that seems very, I watch a show called Supernatural. I'm sure mm-hmm. people have heard of it. Very supernatural, like, you know, get the body, burn the bones to kind of get the ghosts to leave. But again, kind of what you said earlier, that is definitely an aspect of heightening the drama in the movie that did not occur in the book. I'm curious if the movie was made in America or if it was made in England, because I know this also feels like a very British story, which I know that's sounds like a funny thing to say, but, and I feel like it's probably a British movie as well, like made in England, but I just feel like,
well, yeah, you know, it, that is something to think about, because, you know, maybe, you know, certainly the actors and the setting where they filmed it was in England, but in terms of the producers, like who the money behind the movie, maybe they were American and therefore they wanted the jump scare more.
Yeah. Interesting to think about. I don't know, but
yeah. So, but basically, I don't know, let's talk about the woman in black. So ultimately, Arthur finds out through all of Mrs. Drablow's old letters that basically the woman in black was Mrs. Drablow's sister, who had a child out of wedlock and at first was very adamant about keeping the child, but then ultimately, because of a variety of social pressures, ended up giving the child to her sister and her husband to raise, and, you know, to protect, like, you know, the, you know, the good name of the family and whatnot. And so it got to a point where the woman in black, she tried to like pose as her son's nanny on the condition that she would never tell. But then she had this scheme that she was gonna run away with her child. But before she could, the child died, you know, in the carriage in the marsh.
Right. Right. Yes.
So, yeah, just, I don't know, just very classic. Like, again, I don't know why it's so compelling. Because, like, again, also when I heard of the story the first time via the movie, you know, I'm just like, this is so simple, but it's so good.
I think you're exactly right. There's like, I feel like some of the books that we've read in this genre are complex, and there are a lot of different ways you can kind of analyze something. But this is like elegant in its simplicity. I don't know if that sounds like a ridiculous thing to say, but I really enjoyed this. And did not feel like it was like a dumbed down version of a gothic novel. Like none of that. It just was, you know, because sometimes it's like we go from reading like what, like a 700 page book full of all kinds of things to this, which is pretty
convoluted nuns and whatever.
Right, right. And then we have this kind of about 200 page story that's effective. It hits the gothic points. It is a, you know, a little scary. And I think that, you know, I think one of the most kind of chilling things about this story was the idea of hearing that horse and child like drowning in the marsh. Like,
I was just going to ask you what you thought the scariest part was, because that was my scariest part, because I've ridden horses. And so to just have to hear a horse suffer and just yeah. like that, it would just be like, ugh.
I've never seen a never ending story, which given my age, it's that's what it made me think of. I've seen images of that scene and I was like, oh no. So I can't imagine, like, sometimes, you know, the unexplained noise is for some reason that just like, when you're reading it, I was thinking, this is horrible to think about, but like, again, what a great way to kind of evoke terror in reading something, just something so kind of subtle and scary and you can't see it. And anyway, that's obviously, that kind of hits the points. Is that the part that you found kind of the most terrifying as well?
Yeah, the most terrifying. And I think it was interesting, again, like Arthur thinking philosophically of like, okay, even if we accept that there's like ghosts and stuff, can she truly physically harm me in any way beyond just, you know, like scaring me into doing something stupid?
Yeah.
Which was a good philosophical point, because in a way, the way she ended up killing his son and his wife was stepping in front of the carriage, which she let the horse see her, and then the horse went out of control. So she herself, like, can't do anything. She just threw the terror of being a ghost and be like, ah, ghost, and people do dumb things.
Yeah, because he never, like, it's not a situation where she touches him and, oh my God, you know, something happens. It's just like her presence. I was going to say physical, but that's not accurate at all. Her presence is just evokes that, like, just bad things to happen. Again, this is, you know what, this is, I always talk about how much I like ghosts, like, oh, ghosts are so interesting, or like the ghost that's not a ghost. And then I was like, as I was listening to this story, I was like, this is a reason people are scared of ghosts. I have not understood that. Like, I feel like this is what people, you know, the bad thing that happens. So often in our reading, we've seen that, or we've read that the ghost is not a ghost. It's a person. It's, you know, something else. In this situation, it was definitely an entity, and bad shit happens when you encounter that entity. So good on that for being a good, scary ghost. They are giving ghosts their terror back.
Of course. And so, yeah, I'm just trying to think of what other notes. I think one thing was interesting is just Arthur's typical, like, in Gothic literature, I guess, or modern horror, like, just the morbid fascination that he feels like he cannot resist the temptation of going to Ealhmarsh House.
Yeah. It evoked a couple of things. Like, first of all, just stay away. I guess he felt so compelled to do this job, and I kind of didn't really understand why he was compelled, other than just to kind of maybe prove it to himself. I know there's an element of that. But the other thing it kind of reminded me of is, one, I have too many papers all over. Like, I need to not be that person. I think about, like, I have a box of, you know, documents from 2014 that I probably need to get rid of. And the second thing, just kind of like that agonizing process of going through the mundane, looking for something that, of meaning, you know, having had family members pass away, and that act, you know, falling upon the family to go through documents and try to find things that are meaningful. That was just, I don't know, that just kind of evoked that memory for me of that act. And he didn't mm-hmm. know this woman. He knew that people weren't too psyched that he was hanging out at the house. But I just thought that was an interesting way to kind of create some terror in that. Something that just seems kind of mundane in a process when people die. It's just something like a task, you know, which he very much tried to treat. Like, I just have to go here and I have to do this thing. I hear the horse and the noise. I just got to do this thing. It was just interesting.
Yeah, no, it's interesting you bring that up, because I think I texted you earlier this week saying, being like, I'm so happy I got a really cool edition of Dr. Zviago.
Yeah.
At at Goodwill. But what's interesting about that Goodwill trip is, like, by looking through all the books that were there, and I got a lot of editions of, again, classical books, like, just the nature of all the books that were there and, like, the kind of similar vibe of the books, it honestly felt like, I think some, like, since I had last been to Goodwill and was looking at the books, I think someone, an elderly person, may have died and all of their books just got donated at once.
Oh, wow.
Like, it didn't seem as random as going through the books as previous visits. So I felt like, in some ways, like, a lot of books, I'm like, I feel like this maybe was part of someone's, like, whole collection.
Interesting. Have you found anything in any of those books yet? Or,
like, in terms of what?
Like, it made me think of a friend of mine got, like, a collection of Shakespeare. Like, I don't remember what it, you know, what the significance was. But she found a letter in the back of it. And it was written by someone who was in a psychiatric hospital. Very odd letter. But she's like, she came into work one day and she was like, "You like weird things. Here you go." And I was like, okay. So the thing is, I don't have it at my house because I'm like, it gives a weird vibe. But I just think, I was just curious if you found something, like, maybe like a check, or, you know, people use weird things.
No, I haven't looked through all of them so far. I got Dr. Zviago, Madame Bovary, D.H. Lawrence, Lady Chatterley's Lover, like, oh, nice. Like, some really good ones. And, but in terms of going off that, what I did find once is at a library discount bookstore, I found a 1917 edition of, like, a poetry anthology.
Okay.
And again, the book was published in 1917, but I opened the book and someone's, like, English class assignment was there, and it was typewritten, like, dated 1931.
Oh, cool. I think you've mentioned that, but that's
yeah, cool. No, I probably have. Yeah, that's the only sort of relic I have. But anyway, so how do we get on this? Oh, yeah, just Arthur going through all of her, like, possession. Yeah.
Well, if anybody goes through my books, they'll find pressed leaves, because that's what I'm into for some reason. That's what I do with my books. But just kind of, I think we were talking about just that you found all these books at a book sale because somebody probably passed on and may have let those books be sold. Well, cool. I mean, it sounds like you got some good stuff.
Yeah, I did, but it was just kind of creepy thinking about it.
Yeah, I know, it is a little eerie.
So, like, I got a few book discussion questions off the internet for Woman in Black.
Perfect.
Yeah, so do you think the Woman in Black will always haunt Arthur? Has he fully moved on?
Well, and maybe I'm unclear on this, she doesn't seem to attach herself to a person from my knowledge, but it was more just, I mean, I got the impression that she committed, like, this heinous act and then kind of was like, okay, I'm done. I don't know. I don't think, it sounds like kind of like what you talked about at the beginning. He's telling this story. He's been remarried. There are four stepchildren. They're still living at this point. He's trying to get this story out to kind of, like, exorcise the demon a little bit. So I don't know. I thought he was kind of done with her. I felt like this was the act that she committed. And then she was like, all right, I killed your wife and your child and we're done. But what do you think?
Yeah, I think kind of feel that too. Like, it was a definite, like, there was a finiteness to it. Like, in terms of haunting psychologically, I did think from Arthur telling that story, it shows that he won't fully ever be free on a psychological standpoint. But yeah, I think, you know, she very specifically got her revenge on him for, like, I don't know, disturbing her or whatever. But
yeah, good question.
Yeah. What is the deal with Samuel Daly? Why is he so intent on helping Arthur out?
Good question. I don't know, other than he's just, like, bored or something. I guess I didn't understand that when I was reading. I don't think he was just trying to, like, be a friend. Maybe my assumption, and I don't know, maybe this says more about me, is that he was looking for some financial gain due to, like, the excavation of the house. I guess that's not the right word, but the kind of digging through all of her things. What about you?
I think he was partially maybe trying to be nice, because I think it's pretty much established that even though he's a pretty wealthy guy, like he, I don't know if he directly says this or most of the townspeople speculate, like, not even Sam Daly will go after Eel Marsh House. He knows better than that.
Okay.
So yeah. I think maybe it's not, it's helping Arthur, but at the same time, not so much helping Arthur for the sake of helping Arthur. It's more helping him out because, like, if he continues to, like, he knows the deal that every time this woman is seen, a child dies. So I think he's just trying to act in the interest of the community of why should this community suffer in a way for this, like, stranger coming in and out and causing chaos to us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, again, which is played up a lot in, you know, the movie because more children die. And so there's significantly more hostility towards Arthur and then Sam who helps him. Because every time Arthur is getting pulled deeper and deeper into this story and this mystery, more children are dying. And, of course, all of the villagers and the parents are pissed.
Rightfully so. I think that.
Rightfully
yeah,
so.
Yeah, it's not as, it's, and I'm going to have to go back and watch the movie because it definitely sounds like it's more, everything is heightened in the movie, more over the book.
Mm-hmm. So here's another one. Why does Janet, aka the woman in black, think it's okay to exact revenge on other people's children? Does she think they were actually responsible for the death of her son, or is she just messing with everyone?
I'm laughing at myself. I mean, who knows why ghosts do what they do? It would be, I guess we could, you know, another, if the author chose to write another book, which I guess there is a sequel to this. I don't know anything about it other than that it exists. The Woman in Black, Angel of Death. Oh, that's the film.
Yeah, there's a film sequel, but yeah, I don't know if she ever wrote anything.
I would be curious because it would kind of be like, it would be interesting to see her, like, why would she decide to do that? Other than she's mad, and it's kind of like the whole thing of like, well, I'm miserable, so you're going to have to be miserable too. That was kind of my only thought about her guiding, like, what her
underlying motivation.
Yeah. That's kind of all I thought. She was just like, well, I'm mad at everybody. Which, I mean, that's kind of like, what's going to happen? She's just kind of an evil entity in a way. Doesn't get a lot of backstory. Would be interesting to know her motivations, but I also think that kind of is the appeal in this story. It's pretty purely like, this is a ghost story. We don't get a psychological evaluation of her. We just kind of go, okay, the woman in black likes to kill kids. She's scary. And here we go. What about you? What do you think?
Again, I think it is the typical, like, you know, I got screwed over in life, so therefore I have the right to screw over anyone that crosses my path.
Yeah.
Because if I couldn't be happy, then no one is going to be happy.
Yeah.
Which, again, seems like very basic, but also very human.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, how many times do we encounter that in more subtle ways? I think we encounter that every day. And my husband and I talk about little things like that all the time. So that people do.
Okay. What does the Eel Marsh house represent? What is the location? Why is the location such a central part of the story?
Because it's a good old classic gothic book. And that just is part of the nature of the book. No, it creates an ominous tone that makes that book, you know, I feel like maybe a little bit the movie has tainted my thought process on this, but the fog and just kind of the gray and just the deterioration. I don't know. It's a great classic gothic setting, even though it's not a castle, it's not a crumbling castle, but kind of like in the 13th tale, that wasn't a castle either, right? It was just like a nice home.
It was Angelfield Manor. Yeah, it was a manor house.
Okay. All right. So I don't know. That was kind of my assessment.
Well, I feel like in the beginning of the book, again, interactions between, you know, the townspeople and then hearing them talk about Samuel Daly, I did get a little bit of a classism vibe.
Mm.
Kind of, again, the typical, like, they were the most well-to-do people in the town. And they probably, even without all the supernatural stuff, probably were not the most popular because, again, they were just wealthy and maybe didn't do a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
To help out the community, and then on top of the normal class, you know, envious issues, and on top of all that, there's the supernatural crap that's plaguing the village. So,
right.
And I think, of course, like Eel Marsh House, like the location, I think it's for as classical as a ghost story as it is, like the whole thing with the marsh and the quicksand, you don't see that as often.
The dang quicksand, that's something that the scared, I mean, that was scary too. We're going to talk about points like, of terror.
I would happily go into the quicksand for my cat.
Yeah, me too. I'm terrified of the quicksand. Having done, some outdoor, I remember being at like sand dunes and watching a lot of cartoons as a kid. And it was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to get sucked up under by quicksand, which is, that part was scary too. So the
noise. I guess it just has a pull over my imagination because for all the traveling I've done, I've never encountered quicksand. Like all I can do is imagine the sensation because it just makes no sense to me. Like it's not water, you can't drown, but you can't move. And
it just sounds horrible. Like it's just giving me, you gave me a chill just saying that. So adding that in the story was, again, effective terror.
Mm-hmm. All right. Oh, good. Another good question. Why doesn't anyone tell Arthur the whole story about the house and the haunting when he arrives?
I wondered that myself. I kind of that's a good question because when I was listening to the story, I'm guessing they were trying not to dissuade him from doing his work. I mean, and try to get things taken care of. But when I finished this book, I was like, why did we wait until the end before somebody was like, by the way, that just seems kind of unkind. Maybe there's a hesitancy to talk to engage strangers that much. I don't know, but I
think there could be a few possibilities. Number one, he is a stranger and therefore he's not well established, in the town folklore. So he may not believe it. So that's one possible reason. I think at this point, like the way they act in such terror, I think maybe from past experiences with the woman in black, that if you try to dissuade anyone that she's targeting, like you will see her too. And then you'll get screwed over.
Okay.
Because, yeah, like, otherwise, if there was no tangible threat to be like, hey, because you wouldn't even have to say, oh, it's haunted. Like, try and make up some other excuse to get Arthur to not go. Like, oh, it's contaminated with whatever.
Yeah, that is a good point about, I'm sorry, you were talking, just the protectiveness and the fact that the townsfolk might not, they might say, like, we all know that this is true. But this guy might just, kind of think we're kind of crazy weirdos or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I think it's very, the way I interpret it in my own headcanon is that if someone had substantially tried to interfere, that that might have brought on their own sighting of the woman in black and all the terror that follows.
Yes, that was the, I also wanted to point out that, yeah, self-preservation. That, they're saying, okay, well, it's just, I don't want it. I don't want my kids to be goners. So a little bit of self-preservation there as well.
Alrighty then, shall we move into the gothometer?
Sure, let's do it.
Alrighty then, so gothometer, category number one, atmosphere and setting.
I'm going to give it a 10 because I have said again, it hit all the boxes for me as far as atmosphere and setting. Even being British, to me, it feels like, oh, there's some, it's just, or, taking place in England is, I don't know. That's my 10. I feel like that when I think of a gothic setting, I would think of the setting in this book.
Yep. And for all those reasons, I too am giving it a 10. And both with the old manor house, the secluded village, the fog, and I feel like, more so than others, like even in Wuthering Heights, we get, like, we don't get any super like descriptors of like the moors or anything, or like nothing of substantial, like there's no carriage sinking in the marsh in Wuthering Heights, right, like there is in this story. So the physicality of the setting is much more a part of the story than maybe in others.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's agree 100%.
Okay, category number two, the past.
Oh, okay. I'm going to give it an 8 for the past, even though I probably should give it a 10 because of the whole story is him reflecting on the past and telling, the story, and even an additional past, I guess we would talk about the story of the woman in black and how that her story came to be. So an 8.
Yep, I too gave it an 8.
psychic. Oh my goodness. That's
yes, awesome. For all of those things. And again, of course, me placing more emphasis on the history of the woman in black, that clearly she's developed a reputation for herself because all the villagers are terrified. And then also having to relive the past of the terrible, you know, carriage sinking in the marsh.
Right. Yeah. Horrible, like the past is ever present with those noises too.
Indeed. Category number 3, the supernatural.
A 10. I feel like I almost didn't give it a 10, and then you gave it a 10 too.
You can't not give this a 10.
Right.
For supernatural.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's pretty self-explanatory.
Just like Dracula. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Alrighty, category number 4, heroes, heroines, and villains.
I'm going to give it a 6 because the female characters, okay, the woman in black I know is a woman, but like the story is mainly Arthur's story. And he is the only character in my opinion that has any sort of substance. Like I could meet him. I hope I don't meet the woman in black. But that's my reason for the... Did I say 6? I don't even remember.
Yeah, you said 6.
Okay. Yeah. How about you?
I gave it a 7 because, again, very stark and obvious villain. And maybe not the most original, like, backstory to her, but one that, you know, is a story. And it kind of understands why she would be so malevolent and vengeful, because that was just a sad reality of those times of women, like, especially, you know, in that time, being forced to give up their children. Like, there are horror stories of, like, these specific convents particularly in Ireland, because mm-hmm. they're Catholic and much more rigid about marriage and those sort of things. Like, of just bones of children or bones of, like, unwed mothers. Like, you know, they treated them horribly.
Yeah, I actually know somebody whose father has no idea who his parents are. He was from Ireland. He passed away. But there was a movie that came out a couple of years back that really highlighted some of that. And very sad, very sad.
Yeah, it's just really morbid. So just the reality of that, like, as simple as it is, that is rooted in a deep sense of realism of what, you know, unwedded women had to go through if they were with child.
Yeah.
And so she was a good villain in that regard. And again, Arthur, the hero, I wouldn't say he's too complex, but again, he's sort of go lucky. I need to do my job. So you like him. So yeah, all those things, I give it a 7.
Cool.
Then category number 5, mystery.
Okay. I'm going to give this a 10. And the reason I'm going to give it a 10 is because I totally forgot why the woman in black was who she, you know, kind of like did the things she did. And it jarred me. Like, I forgot her story. And I thought, wow, that's really dark. You know, just her motivation was dark. The incident was dark. And then but we're not privy to that information until the end. So I'm going to give it a 10. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, for me, I'm giving it an 8. Again, it wasn't a shocker and mystery because I remembered why exactly her relationship with the child and relationship to Miss Drablo and all that, and why she was terrorizing all children, because it was, again, the typical, like, if I can't be happy with my kid, then none of you can be happy with your kids.
Gosh, yeah.
Like, looking at it objectively, had I not known the story, yeah, it's a good... sort of like it's revealed well, and it's evened out between like the two parts when Arthur finds out, you know, exactly who she was and how she gave up her child, and then at the end the big reveal of that was her physical past or in life, and then we realize her past in death when Sam says every time you see her a kid dies. So it was, I liked that the reveals were evenly spaced out and there wasn't just a dump at the end.
Yeah, that's a good point. It didn't just onslaught with it wasn't like a big reveal, it was a tempered, which she appreciated.
Alrighty then, so I've tallied them up. I gave it a 43 out of 50 and you gave it a 44 out of 50.
That is a big number for me. Usually I'm on the lower end, so
yes, interesting. No, but again, it's just it's not just gothic, it is the ultimate classic English countryside ghost story.
Yes. And I think we're both very much here for that. So cool.
Yes, we are. So luckily, I think I only have a few hours left before my Kindle takes away my my copy of Woman in Black, because I checked it out, like the ebook from my library.
Oh, okay, perfect.
So I still have it, so let me quickly find a random place for our rereading.
Okay.
So, although it was early November and this a cold corner of England, when I stepped out of the Gifford Arms after enjoying a remarkably good breakfast, the air was fresh, crisp, and clear, and the skies blue as a blackbird's egg. The little town was built for the most part of stone rather than austere gray slate, and set low, the houses huddled together and looking in on themselves. I wandered about, discovering the pattern of the place. A number of straight, narrow streets or lanes led off at every angle from the compact market square in which the hotel was situated, and which was now filling up with pens and stalls, carts, wagons, and trailers in preparation for the market. From all sides came the cries of men to one another as they worked, hammering temporary fencing, hauling up canvas awnings over the stalls, wheeling barrows over the cobbles. It was as cheerful and as purposeful a sight as I could have found to enjoy anywhere, and I walked about with a great appetite for it all.
I think that did a great job of kind of displaying or kind of setting up the setting. I was trying so hard not to say that, but
establishing the setting.
Establishing. Thank you. See, if I need a word doc in front of me, because then I can sit there and go, oh, that's what I meant. Yeah, I think that was a great way to reiterate something we both, you know, because sets the atmosphere and the tone for.
Yeah, but I liked it because as much as it is setting the tone of like, okay, this is the classic quintessential English small village and whatnot. It also, in this way, I think it's showing the actual, like, probably the most uplifting part of the story. Like when he's out in the marketplace and, you know, people are selling like their produce and their cheeses and they're drinking ale and everyone's happy and yada, yada, yada. That's probably as uplifting as this story gets.
You're exactly right. It did end on a relatively like kind of upbeat little like, oh, and everything was wonderful, and which is a change from the rest of the book. So
yeah, because it reminds me of when I go to the farmer's market and it's like I go to the little stall where the Amish are and I get their special goat cheese.
That sounds delicious.
So it is very delicious.
Some goat cheese
with dill in it.
Ooh, man, I'm gonna have to go eat all the cheese in my fridge now.
Yeah, I just finished up all my Manchego cheese today.
Oh, man. I'm thinking of this, what is it? It's like a blue cheese, like a really crumbly, I can't think of the name of it right now. But
I hate, you're like my husband, but I hate blue cheese.
Well, it's not for everybody. It's kind of,
it's not. But yeah, so again, cute little farmer's market. I miss those. It's the ultimate activity in the pre-COVID times.
I know. Yeah, we have where I live, we have a big market downtown, which is always really fun to go to and hang out at. And I haven't gotten any cheese, but I'll have to do that. I usually get some honey from there. Mm-hmm. And I've missed that as well this year.
Yeah, like we would have one. It would be, of course, every like Saturday, you know, well, on all the months where the weather would allow. And so every week would be the like all the food and stuff, and then once a month near the same place there would also all the artists would be there and have all their wares as well.
Oh, cool. That's nice. Yeah. Oh, now you're making me long for the pre-COVID times, just as we're about to be like shut in for winter. So I'll just imagine myself to those places.
Yes, indeed. Me too. Alrighty then, and that, folks, was The Woman in Black. Thank you so much for tuning in, and don't forget to tune in next time where we'll be rejoined by Morgan Chalfont as we go over Carmilla by
Charlotte. Oh, I cannot wait. I love Carmilla. I don't know if I love her as much as Dracula, but I love Carmilla.
You were the first one to expose me to Carmilla, and so I actually have already read it even before this podcast. I read it in my Gothic literature book club, but yeah, like again, she dies exactly as Dracula dies.
It has been a little while. I need to reread it. There's also a Canadian TV show that is based on it, kind of like a modern retelling. I watched it. It was kind of like a little YouTube series, and I believe it became a TV show. I want to kind of check that out, but just to kind of see the modern take on it. And we all know Morgan likes vampires, so
of course. Yeah, so Morgan will be rejoining us for that. So stay tuned, everyone. Take care. Bye.
Bye.